one, which is actually 102. The agency is withdrawn, the majority of it. And again, Mr. Johnson, I'm sure, will go, or Ms. Hadley will go into detail on that. So just so I don't repeat what Valentina and the agency are going to say, I guess we'll turn it over to DAS for their presentation, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Why don't we go ahead and get started? It's nice to have you this morning. Identify yourself and let's get going.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. My name is Valentina Fomenko. I'm with the Budgeting Management Division, Department of Administrative Services. I'm going to start today by presenting a brief overview of this budget, the governor's recommended budget, and then just to give you some context for the decisions that have been made, and then I will turn it back to the agency to provide a more detailed discussion of the budget. On page 2 of the handout, there is some statewide context for this budget. Board of Medical Examiners is included in the Consumer and Business Services Program area, and within that program area, the total budget of about $7 million accounts for less than 1% of the total spending, and there is no general or lottery funds involved. Within the governor's principles budget, the Board of Medical Examiners is linked to the principle related to health and basic needs of Oregonians. Slide 4 shows how the board is financed. And as you see...
Okay. As we get going, help us follow along with you so that we know where you're at. Like you said, slide 4, and I'm not sure where slide 4 is.
Excuse me.
We're going through this. All right.
Thank you.
There'll be somebody. Well, I guess we don't have too many people here. I assume that this is being recorded, and so if we're going to be referring to pages, did you want to have them show up on the projection, or is that not to be done?
That's not to be done, Mr. Chair.
That's later. Okay. Please proceed.
So, as I already mentioned, Mr. Chair, all of the agency's expenses are covered by other fund sources, and the major source of other funds is licensing fees. It accounts for about 96% of total revenue. Page 5, there's a graph showing program units within the agency. And the majority of operations happens in the operations program unit. About 87% of expenditures belongs to that unit. And also there's a small diversion program which provides monitoring and treatment of licensees with substance abuse problems. Next slide shows breakdown by budget category of expenditures by budget category. And personal services, the highest, is the largest part of expenditures. It's about 66% of total spending. 33% is servicing supplies, and special payments are less than 1%. It's a new budget category in this budget, and it's related to a policy package and includes payments to state police for background checks. The next slide number 7, shows basically a steady increase in the number of positions, NFT, and also in expenditures over the last several biennia. And there are several policy issues that are going to affect the agency's budget. First, there is the number of licensees has grown over the last several biennia. So did the number of consumer complaints, and it resulted in increased number of investigations and also increased need for follow-up and compliance monitoring. And the agency has a policy package that is attempting to address this situation. And Mr. Johnson, Ms. Haley will talk more about this. Another issue is criminal backgrounds check, and the agency has substantive legislation going through that would provide statutory authority to perform FBI checks on all license, new applicants for a license. And there is a policy package that requests experiential limitation for this piece. And also, as of March 1st this year, Oregon State Police increased their fees for the state portion of this criminal background check. And the governor's recommended budget does not include this assumption, so there will be probably need to increase that limitation. And finally, as Deborah already, Ms. Mather already mentioned, the last policy package, majority of that has been withdrawn by the agency. However, there is a part that's related to an increase in rent, in facilities rent, that was related to the agency's move to another location, and that's located at the diversion program. This was done to accommodate the growth in the diversion program. And again, Ms. Haley and Mr. Johnson will talk more about this one. This is all I had to say for today, and I will be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? That was very clear. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westland.
Before we go on, could I just ask on page 1 of 11 in the budget support detailed review expenditures, item number 705, I believe it is, sales income.
I'm looking for the tab. Which tab was that?
It's
the very last one.
Yeah.
Which one?
Budget support doc. Don't let me throw you off kilter and get it offline. I'm sure there's got an easy explanation for that. But.
Mm-hmm.
Charges for services, I think I understand.
Okay, I'm now with you on
sales income.
Page 1 of 11. Detail revenues and expenditures.
Mm-hmm.
Chair Richardson, for the record, Bruce Johnson. And I'm sorry, what page are you on, Chair? 11?
Behind the budget support documents.
Okay.
Tab.
It's about 8 pages into the last tab.
Mm-hmm. And you're on 705, sales income?
Right.
That's that represents about 4% of our total revenue biennially, and it represents sale of license verifications, sale of lists of our licensees to hospitals, insurance companies, sale of electronic media to the same consumers.
Just follow up, Mr. Question.
Follow up.
Do we, I mean, I understand Adam Smith and Lazy Fair. How do we price those? Are we competitive? Do we charge more, less, about the same?
In looking at our statute, it mandates us to charge to offset the actual cost. So we'll make a look at what it actually costs for staff or to produce this, and then we price it accordingly.
So no profit center whatsoever?
No profit center.
Well, there's the first good idea we've had on this budget, Mr. Chair.
All right, so let's.
Good morning, Chair Richardson, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. With me this morning is Dr. David Watt. He's a member of the board and serves on the board's investigative committee. Mr. Bruce Johnson, who's our Assistant Executive Director, and Ms. Carol Brandt, who is our Accounting Supervisor. We are in Phase 2 of our budget presentation, and that's on page 13.
Of which section?
13 where?
Of the budget presentation document. the blue covered book.
This book, the last the book from the last time you were here.
Last, this one?
Yes.
That's why you couldn't find my desk. Do you have an extra one?
In phase one of our budget presentation, we went over a lot of the board responsibilities and committee work that's done by the board. In this phase, we'll be going through the major divisions of board staff and its work. The mission of the board, to reiterate, is to protect Oregonians through the regulation of the practice of medicine in a manner that promotes quality care. Our big divisions are license services, investigations and compliance, the health professionals program, our technical and support services, and our administration. And from here, I'd like to go into detail on each of those divisions. So I would then be turning to page 14 of your presentation book. Our license services division reviews all applications that come in the door for licensing for as physicians, physician assistants, podiatrists, and acupuncturists. We receive approximately 2,000 new license applications per year and renew licenses on over 14,000 licensees on a biennial basis. We do respond to over 12,500 requests for license information, and that is the telephone calls that come in on a regular basis asking questions about a license application. And the overall way in which this ties into the board's mission to protect the public is careful review of those applications and at the same time trying to provide them on a timely basis to the employers that need the physicians and other healthcare professionals. Throughout this presentation this morning, I renew the commitments that were made in the phase one presentation, and that is to public safety, accountability, and the wise use of our licensees' resources. Careful review of these license applications ties into the public safety mission, and the timeliness of those ties into our wise use of resources and also our accountability. That department also handles all of our rulemaking for all the divisions of the board operation, and they develop and coordinate the agendas of the board committees for acupuncture, physician assistant, podiatry, as well as emergency medical services. I'll then be turning to page 15, and Mr. Johnson will handle the next couple of slides.
The slide on page 15, this graph shows our MDDO and podiatric license applications increasing on average 7% per year. We're down a little bit from our peak in 2001, just 6.5%, and then when I look at 2003 and 2004, it's about the same number of applications coming in. And I took a look just last week to see what the activity was for the first 3 months of this year, January, February, March, and then I compared that to the 3 months in 2004. And we're up about 28% in our applications. So I think this trend has leveled off and now is probably starting to go back up again like it did in the late 90s. There are some cost contributors for this licensing function. Approximately 30% of our regular applicants receive special review by staff, by our executive director, by our medical director. And of these 30%, about 100 of the most difficult applications are forwarded to our administrative affairs committee, which is a group of four physicians and one public member, for their review and recommendation. And then from there, recommendations are made on licensing for these difficult applications to the full board.
Okay, Mr. Johnson. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to, there's always conflict here for me in that I'm a physician and this is the board that licensed me, so I'd like to make that record that I recognize that conflict. But I had a question about this chart because the mission of the board is to make sure that the delivery of health care to Oregonians is safe. Part of that is adequate numbers of physicians. And I get these incredibly conflicting reports about the adequacy of the number of physicians in the state of Oregon from the point of view of this keeps going up. but I keep seeing that physicians are retiring earlier and earlier, that physicians are working part-time. We have more and more people licensed in the state who commonly don't actually practice in the state, but you still have to go through the process of licensing them, and they are not coming here to practice. And I wonder if you can comment on what you think the pool of physicians really is in the state and what we're looking at for the next 5 or 10 years. If you have any information about that, I'd like to hear what that is just quickly here.
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, I think you raise a very good question for us, and that is, you're right, we show the number of applications that come in the door, and we also show the number of physicians who are in active practice. However, that doesn't say whether or not they practice one day a week or half a day a week, but there are definitely shortages in individual specialties like neurology, obstetrics and gynecology, and that's particularly acute in the rural areas. Probably the best data we have comes from the Health Sciences University, who did a study in 2002 that showed some of those shortages, but there hasn't been an updated survey to indicate that since then.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Senator Bates.
This is one of the best ways that that you have to communicate with the legislative process. And I think in the future, if you could gather that information, if at all possible, and present it along with this, because this gives the impression that we've got lots of physicians, there's plenty coming in, there's more coming in every year. But I'm not sure that reflects the reality. It reflects the reality of what you have to do to license these people, but does not, I don't think, reflect the reality of what we actually have as far as supplying physicians in the state. And I'm concerned that just as we have a nursing shortage that we're up against right now, we may have a physician shortage in 5 or 10 years that'll have the same problem. And the pipeline for a physician is not 2 to 4 years as it is for a nurse. Mm-hmm. It's 12 to 14 years. That's a tough pipeline to fill.
Mm-hmm.
So in the next go-around, it's 2 years from now, if you could bring that information in along with this, it might be worthwhile to see. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moss-Hanson.
Every time I renew my nursing license, they always have a survey with my nursing license form. And so they have an update every time we renew. And one of the it's long. One of the questions is, you know, do you work part-time or not? Are you retired? Your specialty? Those types of things.
Chair Richardson, Senator Mona Sanderson, and Senator Bates, we have recently met with the Medical Association, and we were going to be contacting the Health Sciences University because we have done those surveys as well and included them with the license renewal, and that's what we've been discussing about setting up another survey instrument and, again, sending it out with our renewals. So I appreciate the comment.
Is it correct that you have not done that in the recent years, though?
Chair Richardson, we were relying on the Health Sciences University, and we were working with them, and they came out with a pretty extensive document in 2002.
Okay. I'd like to go back to a discussion that we had during our last meeting, and it involves licensing, because as I look, I see limited license applications, regular applications. I see the graph, and I brought up the fact that I felt that there's an inherent ethical issue in the licensing procedure, and I'm wondering if you have given that any thought and if you've discussed that with any board members and if you have any response to that today.
Chair Richardson, I did send you a follow-up letter after the phase one testimony that it is going to be on the board's April 14th agenda. So
I haven't seen that.
I sent it in the few days after the phase one testimony.
All right. I've been thinking a lot about this, and I think that it's more important than merely being on an agenda. I want to know specifically that it's going to get addressed and it's going to get changed, and I'm discussing with co-chairs how we might do that. It is not a neutral issue for me to see a licensing board that has as its mission delivery of health care and make sure the health care is safe for Oregonians, that has what appears to be an implicit protection of its own at the potential expense of patients, whether in this state or other states. And I want to know that that's not going to continue. And so I just want to make it really, really plain that any time a licensing board will give a heads up to applicants if it looks like the applicant is not going to qualify for whatever reason as a result of the investigation, so that that can withdraw their application and not have to have it publicly disclosed as to whatever it might be that might make them unfit to practice, is a huge problem that is that should not be part of a licensing board, in my opinion.
Chair Richardson, I will get back to you after the board discusses it in mid-April. And having it on the agenda is the way in which they will be able to discuss it at that meeting.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Richardson, I'll continue with this slide, and I just have one other point. I was making a prior point about cost contributors, one being the special review by staff, and then second, staff turnover and training. We've had a number of staff that have left for other agencies and for jobs in the private sector, and some others that left for personal career changes, and so that always sets us back a little bit in terms of trying to keep up with the paper and the applications that come in on a daily basis. On the next slide, on page 16, it is a similar view for you, but this time we're showing acupuncture and physician assistants and the trends there. And actually, they're quite similar to what you saw for the physician licensees. These applications are also increasing at the rate of about 7% per year. Some of the cost contributors for this program include...
Mr. Chair?
Senator Wesley.
Is the graph on 16 showing us how many new applications there are, or is this the total and the trend line?
Chair Richardson, Senator Westland, it is showing the new applications, not the total group.
So if I'm reading this correctly, round numbers, just acupuncturists, let's say, in 2002, we're looking at round numbers 200.
Chair Richardson, Senator Westland, that's correct.
In 2002?
In 2002.
Okay, I'm looking at the same graph, so now I'm confused because I see a graph that's almost up to 300 and...
So that's physician assistant.
That's for the total, Chair Richardson, for both groups. But if you...
Okay, I see it now.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Moss Anderson.
Of the physician assistants and acupuncturists, are there very many that are not granted their licenses?
Chair Richardson, Senator Moss Anderson, no.
Yeah.
I mentioned here, too, that this does have a similar trend to the physician graph that you saw earlier, in that I did, again, look at the first 3 months of this year compared to the 3 months in 2004, and these numbers are going back up again. So I think we'll see for 2005 and 2006, the bar is stacking a little higher. Some of the cost contributors for this program, public interest in community, in complementary and alternative medicine, that is continuing. That's been a trend now for at least 10 years. Also, insurance companies now cover this treatment, where in the past they did not. Another contributor are the schools in Oregon. There are two schools each for physician assistants and acupuncture. The acupuncture, there's a school, Oregon College of Oriental Medicine, which has been long established, and now one through the National College of Naturopathic Medicine. There are two schools of physician assistants, one associated with the Oregon Health Sciences University and one at Pacific University in Forest Grove. The other major cost contributor here is the physician assistant practice descriptions, which are up 60% in just 5 years. Physician assistants may only practice under the supervision of a physician, and the scope of what they do must be specified in what we call a practice description. So whenever the scope changes and whenever the supervising physician changes, change in practice description must be sent in and approved by the board. The next slide shows the performance measures for this department. And if
could I have a question, Mr.
Senator Montes-Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. Do you do background checks on physician assistants and acupuncturists?
Chair Richardson, Senator Montes-Anderson, we do a thorough application and employment and that type of thing, but we don't do criminal background checks on anyone at this point.
Okay. But physicians you do?
Chair Richardson, Senator Montes-Anderson, no.
No. Okay.
Slide 17 are our performance measures for this function, and we did go over those with you in phase one, and if it's okay with the committee, we'll just keep going on to slide 18 and back to our executive director.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. For the record, my name is Kathleen Haley. Package 103 is the criminal history verifications, and that was originally House Bill 2059. It has now been joined in general government as House Bill 2157. And that would increase public protection by virtue of the fact that licensees or applicants who apply for licensure would then go through a criminal background check, which would check on a national basis as to whether or not there was any criminal history. Right now, we are asking applicants whether or not they've been convicted of a crime, but we have no way of verifying whether or not they're telling us the truth or not. And having this ability to do the national background checks will allow us to verify that information. We do not intend to hold up the application for that information, but we would be able to go back then and investigate and potentially discipline someone for not being honest on their application. The total cost of this package is $150,142, and that's from existing cash reserves and not from any increase in fees to our licensees. It does include a half-time licensing assistant position at $47,414. That is salary and OPE for the half-time position for the biennium. And that person would process the 1,000 background checks of our new applicants and also assist with that increase that Mr. Johnson was talking about in our applications for acupuncture license that's up 70%, and also those increases in physician assistant practice description changes, which are up 60%. So we do ask for an additional budget limitation of $102,728. That's included in that $150,000 overall. $96,000 of that would go to the state police for actually processing those fingerprint checks for the board. And as Ms.
I have a question for you.
Pardon me.
If the number of applicants for the re-licensing that is taking place through forms obtained off of the internet is increasing, as I think that's what we discussed, then I would assume that that means that the amount of time being spent in processing those applications will be decreasing as far as total number of hours, because you have less touches and less postage and all of that, the processing at the front end of it. And so if you're asking for a half-time licensing assistant position, why would you not be able to assume that under your current staffing, since you have less of a requirement because of the internet utilization?
Chair Richardson, what we have available on the internet is the application itself, which can be downloaded and printed, but then the application still needs to be processed by a staff person. And as you can see, those acupuncture licenses are up 70%, and then the practice description changes are coming in. I think staff were telling me about 30 a month where a physician and the physician assistant who work together as a team would decide that physician assistant was ready to do a new technique. So those are up 60%. So it's those combinations of increases together with the having to process these new background checks that make for the half-time position.
Okay. I have a question for our panel. In all the various hearings that we're having with different agencies, they all seem to have background check people. And I'm wondering if it wouldn't be efficient to have a, you know, a state background check group, and they, that's all, that's what they do, and they, if they do it for everyone. I mean, if, whether you want a real estate license or a nurse's license or a doctor's license, they still have to do a background check, and the background checks are fairly standard as far as what they're going to be looking for.
Just and with a criminal background check.
Mm-hmm.
And all the teachers.
That's right. I mean, they all, and they all have to have their own background check personnel. I just wonder if there'd be efficiency if DAS had a background check group. Anybody know?
Everybody. And because DAS wants to bill everybody for that thing. I can see.
All right.
Well, but it, well, they're anyway. Paying now, and it could be cheaper. And I've got to acknowledge, Mr. Chair, I just thought, you know, for the school teachers and whatever the other background, I thought it was done centralized.
I thought for teachers it was.
Well, the state police do it, but you have to pay the state police to do it. And there's a fee for the state police doing it. But what you're saying, Mr. Chair, is that then each agency has a person who gets the information, gets it together, and brings it back to the agency, and you wonder if it couldn't be more efficient to have a better way of doing it.
Yeah,
everybody just runs through this one agency that does, that's all they do, and then they get information saying yay or nay.
And now the state police are increasing their fee from $36 to $52 as a revenue generator for them. I mean, I wonder if the time is, and that's not our committee, but... So now they're increasing their cost to provide that service. I don't know. It's just something that we'll kind of watch as we have our various committees. Have you any thoughts on that? As far as you look at the background checks that are being performed, whether any of it could be centralized, would that save money?
Richardson, I don't have any immediate thoughts. I think it's really a policy issue for you all and maybe a discussion with DAS about whether or not that's something... they feel confident in taking on.
Okay, thank you.
I wanted to get back to what Dr. Fomenko mentioned earlier, and that is as of March 1, the state police did increase their search by $12 per search, and we anticipate doing 2,400 of them a biennium. So we are underfunded in this package by $28,800. We'd now like to turn to slide 19. That's our investigations and compliance department.
Mr. Chair, could I just interrupt to say that is actually a refreshing remark. We are under budget by...
No, underfunded.
Underfunded by $28,000.
So they need more money?
No, it's still, compared to the numbers we've been dealing with.
Also, no, Mr. Chair, this agency says we're taking on this new task with funds available. They're not asking for increase in fees. They're not asking for general fund dollars. They're willing to take this task on themselves and manage the money carefully.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Our investigations and compliance department handles all complaints that come in regarding the Medical Practice Act and tries to ensure accurate and timely investigative services. And if I could just walk you through a complaint, and that'll cover both this slide as well as slide 20. A caller calls our complaint resource officer, and that individual was once our investigative chief, so he's very familiar with what the 27 potential violations of the Medical Practice Act are and can advise that caller whether it or not that individual's complaint would fall within the Medical Practice Act. From there, a written complaint is received by the investigative staff, and we receive about 540 written complaints against licensees each year. Of those, 330 actually result in investigations. The others would have fallen out as not being within the board's jurisdiction, or possibly the complainant has withdrawn the complaint. From there, our medical director, who is on staff, reviews those cases and consults with the investigator and maybe obtains more information. In addition, he would obtain a consultant if this is a care case. And the consultant in that individual specialty would advise the medical director and the board as to whether or not the care provided by that physician or other licensee fell below the standard of care. The other question for the consultant would be whether or not the care provided constitutes gross or repeated acts of negligence. Assuming,
Senator Wesley.
What do you pay your executive director? Or your medical board?
Medical director?
Medical director.
Chair Richardson, Senator Westland, I believe it's about $115,000.
Salary.
Huh? It's three or four pages from the very back of the book. Please continue.
Once the medical director has reviewed the case and perhaps had a consultant review the materials as well, and some of these I need to tell you are several feet high in patient records. This is not something that can be done immediately. It needs to be carefully reviewed. In addition, one of our board members would be assigned to that for a case review, and they also review all those documents. Then at the monthly investigative committee meeting, which goes all day long until the conclusion of business, and which I would like to invite each of you to attend when you have the opportunity to do so, to observe the board in action, the board member presents the case to the other members of the investigative committee, who are public members as well as physicians, and they review whether or not there's a potential violation, whether there needs to be more investigation to take place, or whether or not the case is ready to be referred to the full board for action. It may be closed at that juncture, or it may go on to disciplinary action. If there is disciplinary action that's going to move forward, there is a complaint notice, which is a public document. That's issued, and then the physician or other licensee has the opportunity to request a contested case hearing. Now, we have about six contested case hearings a year, and those would be on denial of licensure or on disciplinary action. And that contested case hearing runs about $40,000 in cost to the board and takes 2 to 4 days. It takes place before an administrative law judge at the board's offices. Now, our investigative staff are involved in preparing the documents for that contested case hearing or for the settlement, if that's the route that's taken in that case, and for sitting in and advising our assistant attorney general during that contested case hearing. Now, once a case has been concluded, the board does have the opportunity to put a physician or other licensee on probation. And right now, we have 130 licensees on probation around the state. And that is probably at least double what should be handled by one compliance officer. And we only have one at this point. So we would like to increase that to two so that they could divide up the state and divide up the caseload. And a caseload of 65 is more appropriate than 130. Because the types of things that people would be on probation for might include sexual misconduct where there's chaperones. The complaint resource officer would have to go out into the field, meet with a chaperone, make sure that that person was there on a regular basis, check the charts to be sure as well. Now, another function of the investigative department is also to work with our licensing services and to review any cases that come forward out of that department. Then the licensee, if we turn to slide 20, does have the opportunity, this is a list of all the due process available to our licensees, does have the opportunity to appeal it to the Court of Appeals if they're unhappy with the final order. If we could move on to the next slide, that indicates...
Mr. Chair, how many of those are turned over in these? It goes all the way up the food chain, and what percent? Any? Two?
Chair Richardson, Senator Westland, that go to the Court of Appeals?
Right.
I think I've seen probably two in the last 11 years. Go to the Court of Appeals.
And that's...
But about 60 years...
Half a percent or...
Out of 50.
So 4%.
Out of probably 500.
500, it's very tiny.
Yeah, out of 500, 550. Chair Richardson, Senator Westland, however, we do have the six contested case hearings that are pretty lengthy, 2 to 4 days, and expensive as well. And then if we look at the next slide, which is the sources of our complaints, it is, as you might expect, the patients and public who bring most of the complaints to the board's attention. However, we do hear from pharmacies, other providers, sometimes law enforcement, hospitals and institutions. The board has the ability to review all malpractice cases and does so. The board itself may open a case. and sometimes insurance companies also bring cases of fraud to the board's attention. Under the categories of complaints, the largest one is inappropriate care or incompetence that's being alleged, inappropriate prescribing, sometimes personal substance abuse, and unprofessional conduct. In preparing for today's hearing, I went back and looked at the minutes from the first board meeting, and the first board meeting was in 1895, and the issue that was coming to the board's attention was unprofessional conduct then, and it still is unprofessional conduct today. However, in looking back, we were only licensing about 10 people at the board meeting in 1895. There are violations of state and federal law and sexual misconduct that also account for the categories of complaints that the board receives. If we move on to the next slide that is entitled Final Dispositions of Cases, you'll see that the board closes with public orders about 50 cases per year, and of those, a portion of them are reportable to the data bank. Some that would not would be a corrective action order, which would also be a public document but not reportable to the data bank. It generally deals with more remedial type of issues. And as the second chart shows, under the terms of public orders, there are a variety of resolutions that are available to the board members. If we look at the next slide, it is our performance measures. Since we did cover that in phase one, we were prepared to go on to slide on page 24. I wanted to discuss with you briefly the factors that affect the services rendered by our investigations and compliance unit, and that is the number of complaints received, which range from 5 to 700, and the number of investigations that proceed to those contested case hearings that I mentioned earlier, in part because at this point we have one assistant attorney general who works with our investigators, and the investigators do shoulder a lot of that load in preparation for those hearings. In addition, there are some changes in the federal regulations. The HIPAA regulations altered our work pattern slightly. And also, but probably most importantly, the complexity of the cases that the board is dealing with. In this era of online prescribing and the pharmaceutical direct marketing to patients, and so it's become much more complex medical world out there, and so has our investigations. The cosmetic and alternative treatments has raised new issues both for our physicians as well as our physician assistants. And then we're often working with other jurisdictions. We might be working with local law enforcement as well as the FBI. Recently we got a call yesterday from the FBI about one of our absconders that he's now been cited in Beijing, and there's an FBI report to us yesterday about that kind of a case. So these things have taken on really a much broader perspective, and I guess you'd say international. The board is able to share that confidential information with other boards and state agencies pursuant to legislative changes that were made in the last couple of biennia. And then on page 25, we have package 101, which is our compliance and investigations workload. And what we are attempting to address here is the increase that we have seen in the number of licensees who are on probation who are reoffending. And that number has been 12%. And what we would like to achieve with this package is to actually get it down to 6%. And we've seen that increase, we believe, in part because we have this one compliance officer with 130 cases traveling around the state. In addition, with this package, we want to reduce the amount of time that it takes our staff to complete an investigation. We want to get it from 238 days down to 225 days. And the total request for this package is $127,800. And again, this is from existing cash reserves and no increase in fees. It represents a full-time position, which would be half compliance and half investigations, and then a slight increase in an office specialist 2 position from 4 days a week to 5. Now, a normal caseload for a criminal investigator or a healthcare regulatory investigator would be 40 cases. Our staff are handling about 65 cases. So we have the third highest caseload in a survey we did of 15 states, and the third highest caseload per investigator. So we are hoping that this package would address some of those performance issues. At this point, I'd like to turn to our health professionals program. As we mentioned in phase one, that is our diversion program for chemical substance use. And that program encourages the early recognition and monitoring of physicians and other licensees who have substance use problems. It is a confidential program. It's housed in a site away from the board office. And we believe that it ensures public safety through the monitoring of those practitioners. The actual treatment is not done by that program, but the physicians and other licensees are sent to treatment programs, and then the follow-up monitoring is handled by our trained professional staff. We have a medical director on staff there. There is long-term continuing care for this population of about 5 years, and it can be extended if necessary. The other function of that branch of the board is also to do educational outreach, to continually remind hospitals and other professional groups about its existence and the ability that it has to ensure public safety. We've covered the performance measures on that earlier, so if there are no questions, I would continue on to Package 102 and the services for mentally ill licensees.
Any questions?
Okay. One of the areas that we have explored, and we being the board as well as the supervisory council for the health professionals program and psychiatrists in the community, was to look at expanding that program to include mental health. At this time, we've withdrawn this package except for the $16,400 to cover the increase in rent for that program. They moved to larger space. In their existing space that they had, there were some serious risk management issues as well as lack of confidential space for them to actually take someone who is interested in intervention and treatment to come into their office and have a confidential space to have that discussion. This was reviewed by DAS Facilities, and they recommended that we make that move for that program. The program had been in the same space for 15 years, but the staff have increased.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure what your definition of medically ill is for physicians, but we're seeing an increased number of what I call burned-out physicians. They're depressed. And they're anxious. They're being required to see more and more patients every day because of reimbursement issues and cost of maintaining their practices and medical malpractice issues. And we're becoming a little more concerned about their ability to practice medicine as a result of it. I'm not sure that this package is going the right direction. If you need a chance to sit back and say, we're going to define better what this issue is, I'm not talking about schizophrenic individuals or people who are inappropriate in sexual advances to patients. I'm talking about the burned out physician, which is a significant problem. And if you're hoping to look at that, which I hope you are in the interim, and come back with a program you think will help those physicians, then I think that's worthwhile. I don't want to see this just simply go away as we're going to turn our heads away from a significant problem for practicing physicians and hope somebody else takes care of it, because I think this is in your purview. I think this is something you should be looking at.
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, I couldn't agree with you more, and I actually met with one of the Oregon Psychiatric Association physicians yesterday to discuss us continuing this beyond this legislative session. So we intend to continue with working on this issue.
And so in the next session, we might be expecting to see what steps you've taken to deal with this problem.
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, that's what we anticipate.
Thank you.
Well, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Westland.
I mean, maybe I misrepresented Senator Bates' question, but what I'm hearing him say, that as important are the services for mentally ill physicians, a greater problem is kind of the, for lack of a better word, the culture within what you're working in. And so I guess my question would be, if that's a greater problem, why aren't we moving rapidly this session to put such an offering in place to allow physicians to better serve Oregonians?
Chair Richardson, Senator Westland, it's a difficult dynamic to balance the confidentiality, the public protection, and the different needs of those individual principals, and we were unable to come to some consensus about it this session. However, as I said, I believe that we will have a piece of legislation ready for you next session. And I want to assure you that we work on a monthly basis, the medical director and I, with a couple of the psychiatrists in the Oregon Psychiatric Association. We meet on a regular basis, discuss issues and ways in which we can provide treatment, get treatment for these mental health issues to our licensees on an ongoing basis, whether we have it through a confidential program or not.
We'll talk.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, I appreciate your interest in this because it really is a major problem. In one way, we are just kind of looking the way on. Physicians commonly do not want to go and be identified as being depressed or anxious because of the stress of their job because it affects their professional life. And so they avoid that and commonly will self-medicate for it. They'll start taking SSIs or medications, try to make themselves feel better, which is inappropriate, but they feel somewhat trapped, I believe, by that. We see this at the hospital setting primarily where they come and ask for help. But most physicians are doing this in their own office, and I would expect they would not call the BME, but would if the BME had an open line they know they could go to and get help and recognize that help, or their spouses could, or maybe their staff would. But right now, I don't think that is available to them, and a depressed physician who is not functioning well because of that depression is really, to a degree, a danger to his patients, I believe.
You might say that the Bar Association, through the PLF, has an excellent hotline that is completely independent and separate and confidential, so that any attorney that's having problems, whether it's alcohol, drugs, or mental or other things that could affect their life, they can get a call and get help and not have it be reported, so that the goal in that instance is to assure that they get the help that they need and not feel like they're isolated and unavailable to make a call because of the consequences.
Again, Mr. Chair, my only caution is I'm dismayed to see this kind of being put on a back burner and not brought forward in this session. I certainly would like to see it brought forward in the next session and work on the interim very quickly. Thank you.
At this point, I would like to turn this over to Mr. Johnson, who will handle the technical and support services overview.
Excuse me, Chair Richardson, members of the committee. Technical and support services is the fourth major department within the Board of Medical Examiners. And we have two major priorities for ourselves in that department. One is to provide accurate and timely information to the public. And the second is to provide technical and support services that enable the other board staff to better serve the public. We provide direct services as well as support services. Some of the direct services that we do to the public include maintaining a website. We receive almost 700,000 page hits per year on that website, and I think I showed you in our Phase 1 presentation that has a very steep curve in terms of its use. We fill almost 2,000 requests for written verifications from licensure, from other states, from hospitals, from insurance companies, and the like. We respond to 39,000 telephone requests for information, and I'm happy to say that we're still small enough and to be able to take those calls directly. We don't have an automated phone system. When you call the Board of Medical Examiners, you talk to a real person, and we try to make sure that your call is handled as quickly as possible. We also fill 144 requests for database information through electronic media, and of course, technology being what it is, that it has been increasing. We also provide all the traditional business services that you see with the larger agencies that you've looked at, even though there are just 33 of us. And in our business services area, we do all the traditional fiscal services, including budgeting, cash receipts, and disbursement. Excuse me. Also, we provide information technology, human resources. We do purchasing and general services for the agency. We do all the contracting, including our medical consultants, as well as office facilities, telecommunications, and security.
Good question. I see, as I look at the staffing configuration, you've got a total of 36 employees proposed. And 8 managerial or supervisory staff in that, so it actually looks like it comes down to there's 3.5 staff employees per manager supervisor, and I'm wondering if you think that may be an excessive number of managers for the staffing in this size of an organization.
Chair Richardson, we have 5 department managers. I happen to be one, as well as the executive director. So in a small agency, it's not the traditional type of manager. We all have functions as well as managing and directing the work of the people under us. One manager, for example, is our human resources manager. She does all of our human resources for the board, and she supervises the payroll function, which is a part-time function, and she supervises the person on the front desk who answers all the telephone calls about our license information. So, again, these are working positions.
Well, we'd assume. It would be assumed that these would be working positions. If we found out that actually we're just sitting around managing and not doing any work, then that would certainly change things. But there are costs to classification in a government agency of being managed, costs to the people, and I want to just bring it up. Less than 4 employees per manager is not an enviable ratio in business. But I'm looking at the flow chart, and I'm looking at the organizational chart, and I see that you supervise 2 supervisors who each supervise 2 people. And anyway, I just wanted to get your opinion on it. You say that you think it's fully justified because of the structure that you have.
Chair Richardson, we feel that it is because of the size of the agency. I think if you were to look at the specific classifications for those managers, they're not particularly high level in terms of what you might see at a larger agency. One is a salary level 24, the other is a salary level 25. Similar, and actually they're paid less than our investigators. However, they do have responsibility for their area, and that is a good situation when you have a small agency. If I am out sick, then I have 2 other people that I can look to carry on the work.
Okay. Thank you.
On slide 30, you asked for information on use of professional services and purchasing contracts. And I've done a pie chart here to show you the breakdown. The majority of our professional services dollars are for medical consultants, approximately 55%. These consultants are hired by the board to assist with an investigation. They review patient records. They provide written reports. They testify at investigative committee meetings and sometimes, if necessary, at a contested case hearing. And I think it's important to note that since these consultants are also our licensees, that 55% of our professional services dollars are returned to the people who pay them in the first place. From there, about 20% of our professional services dollars goes to miscellaneous contracts. We have one, I think we mentioned in phase one, a person who has come in to do some process improvement work in our licensed services area so that we can better meet our performance measures in that department. We have 10% going to contract temporary staff. This is primarily for seasonal help with license renewal, and then we have 10% for lab services to run checks on licensees who are on probation in the health professionals program. We also make very good use of state negotiated purchase contracts, and we really it's very helpful in a business sense because of the economy of scale for a small agency to be able to access these major contracts. So we use state contracts for our office supplies. We buy all of our computer equipment, our desktops, our servers, printers off of state contract, and then of course our telecommunications and web hosting is through state contract. One on the next slide, one of the major services to the public in this department is our the maintenance and updating of our website. I went over this briefly in phase one, and so I'll maybe just do a quick reminder here of some of the more used features that the public accesses on our website. We have board actions that the public can access, which summarizes recent discipline against licensees. We also have information on how to file a complaint. And I think we've mentioned earlier, too, that our forms are there for licensees to find, and we've made that available to both licensees and the public. The most popular feature of our website is listed at the very top. It says Find a Licensee, and that's the licensee lookup search engine. And when the public accesses that, they will come. They will enter the name of their medical provider, and they will get a screen that looks something like this. This is a lookup on one of our board members, Dr. David Group, internal family practice practitioner from Philomath. And it has the basic information that somebody from the public, as well as an insurance company, a hospital, might like to see in terms of their license status. For example, the standing here is unrestricted, which means that there are no restrictions on the ability to practice medicine. Pursuant to Senate Bill 786, we do survey our licensees regarding their language ability in terms of languages that they speak competently enough for clinical purposes. And Dr. Group speaks German, and we've listed that. The most predominant language spoken by our licensees, and we have that in the appendix, is Spanish. Approximately 17% of our licensees speak Spanish for clinical purposes. The next slide, page 33, are the performance measures again for this group, and we did cover those earlier with you. And for our last department is administration. I'm going to turn this back over to our executive director.
For the record, my name is Kathleen Haley, and the role of the administration in our office is to assist the board in carrying out its legislative mandate. And there is responsibility for all internal and external board operations, and also to be sure that the legal services are provided to the board. One of the things that we do is put out the quarterly newsletter so that our licensees are up to date on what's going on. That also then goes on the website. We work with 11 board members and then 23 additional advisory committee members that come from around the state to serve on the physician assistant or emergency medical technician committees. Those meet on a quarterly basis. We also work with outside entities, including the media. I think I mentioned in phase one that I get at least 1 to 2 media calls per week. We also work with the professional associations and other boards. In addition to supervising and having oversight over the 5 departments that we've detailed for you today, and work with our legal counsel on a very regular basis on settling some of our cases as well as other policy issues that may come to the forefront. On the next slide, you'll see our administration performance measure, and that is the rating on our educational performances. And these are done primarily by the medical director and myself, although board members sometimes do also present on the board and its function. And we try to update our licensees so they know about some of the recent cases as well as other policy issues that are being considered by the board. In January, the board had a retreat on that icy Saturday. The retreat was on continuing competence and professionalism, and out of that will come a statement of philosophy on professionalism that we will attempt to let our licensees know about through these educational presentations, in addition to putting it on the website. And we are meeting that performance measure. On the next slide, we have some of our accomplishments over the last couple of years, and I don't want to run through all of them because they are available for you on the slide. However, I did want to point out a couple, and that is the performance measurement system. And in addition, we're working with the Graduate Medical Education Office and the residency programs to have regular reporting from them on how the residents are doing. So we are trying to set up a culture where reporting to the board is something that is part of their regular activities. In addition, we set up a subscriber base on our renewal of licenses. We have regular meetings with our stakeholders, such as those who credential our licensees, and they wanted us to set up this email subscriber list, which we did for them. We also have our brochure translated into four English and four languages, and we have those here if you have any interest in seeing them. And we set up some new license categories, such as the camp physicians and teleradiology, again, in response to what we were hearing from our licensees. At this point, Mr. Johnson will walk us through the revenue piece.
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, Bruce Johnson. The next couple of slides deal with our budget in a little more detail. This one on page 37 shows you that the Board of Medical Examiners is 100% fee supported. 96% of that comes from license fees and 4% primarily from the sale of lists and license verifications that I had mentioned earlier. The chart also shows the numeric and percentage breakdown of between our license groups and the proportion of funds contributed by each group, and they're roughly proportional when you factor in the other income amount. The other thing I'd point out is that I believe Dr. Fomenko had mentioned earlier that we did lower our fees, and that went into effect in September of 2004. On page 38, I wanted to show you how our fees compare to the rest of the neighboring states. And while we have a number of fees, I wanted to show you this one because about 75% of our total income comes from this one renewal fee. So it's significant. And we do match the lowest of our neighboring states. And I think that I would submit that this is that we're it's an indication that we're providing value to our licensee for the services that they receive. On page 39, I have some detail here on the budget development. And so I'll just go through this with you. Starting at the top, we began the biennium with a beginning balance of $5 million in round numbers. We are estimating a revenue this biennium of $6.9 million, and when I last checked, I think we're going to come in very, very close to that, maybe around $50,000 under. This is reduced. These working funds are reduced by approximately $190,000, and that's through a statutory transfer to the Oregon Health Sciences University Library. Our base budget for 05-07 is approximately was increased by approximately $200,000 for 05-05, and these increases are from statewide PERS rate adjustment and from statewide increases in health benefits.
Okay, just a moment, please. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What is the agency's goal looking at this budget development? What's the agency's goal for the number of months operating budget to have in reserve?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hanna, I would kind of go back to the historical average, and we're probably at the peak this biennium, and we're looking at reducing that from $5 million to $4.7 million, and then we will be going down. But to get back to your question, because of the timing of our cash inflow, we do have a spike early in the biennium, and traditionally our receipts, our cash receipts have been around 58% of our budget. That's just historically.
But follow up, please. But just in terms of number of months, how many months of operating cash flow do you think you need in reserve?
Jurison, Representative Hanna, at a minimum, we need 6 months. And so we obviously have more, and that's why we're trimming our sales a little bit here and trying to act like a business and using an accelerator when needed and the brake when needed. And we put the brakes on now and reduced our fees to try to handle that.
One more follow-up.
Sure.
Based on your reduction in fees, how long do you think it will take you to get to the, say, 6 months operating?
I actually have an overhead that might help with that, and Carol has already put it on. I didn't realize it. I was mentioning that in 03-05, we're at our peak. That black line that's snaking through there shows our ending balance, and because we're going down by about 300,000 in 05-07, that's why that's starting to decline. And in 07-09, we're going to be more kind of at our historical average. But when we get to 09-11, if we do nothing, I would, as my business background tells me, that we'll probably need to take a look at fees at that time, if not a little sooner, because you don't what you don't want to do is surprise licensees with a huge increase. You try to moderate your cash flows such that there's some predictability for the business, if you will, and there's some predictability for your licensees.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
I kind of have a word of caution here. We're looking at a timeline from, it's almost 15 years at 0305, from 89, 91, and you're talking about getting back to your historical amount of cash on hand. Inflation in 15 years has been substantial. The number of licensees has increased substantially. Scope of what you have to do and complexity you have to do, as we know, has gotten substantially different too. I would be cautious about getting back to your baseline of 89-91. I don't know anybody else is trying to do the job you're doing on revenues generated 15 years ago. So I think we had a little discussion this last session, and we knew this was sort of the thing you were looking at, and we were really talking more at that time about what's an appropriate increase in fees if necessary in the next 2, 4, 6 years. Your statement that you were trying to get back to your baseline, I appreciate, but I'm a little concerned where you'll actually be as far as getting your mission done if you do that in 2 to 4 years. I mean, you're looking at a timeline then it's almost 20 years. And your job's not getting easier, it's getting more difficult, and you have inflationary factors you can't control. Just a word of caution from my point of view, Mr. Chair.
Understand. Thanks. Continuing with the overhead on page 39, you also asked for information on our essential packages. And for definition's sake, essential packages are combinations of various technical adjustments. These include phase in and phase out of one-time expenditures, and then statewide adjustments that were allowed for inflation. And when these three items are tallied up for our board, there is a net increase of approximately $172,000. Again, continuing with building the budget here, then we would add in our three policy option packages that our executive director discussed earlier, and those amount to $433,000 totally for an agency request budget of $7.3 million. Now, the governor adjusted our budget downward by about $91,000 in several areas: AG fees, professional services, office supplies, and telecommunications, which then resulted in our governor's recommended budget, which is what you have in your binder today. And then, as the most recent information to bring to the table, we are withdrawing a goodly portion of Package 102, so we would be backing out $139,000 for what I will call a revised budget figure of $7 million. And then this does end up, still, even though with that pulled out, it does end up reducing our ending balance. And that is brings to an end the detailed portion of our presentation and of the very, very last slide. And you don't happen to have it in your binder, but we have it up here. This is the staff of the Board of Medical Examiners, and we just would like you to know who we are. And I thought the best way of doing that is a picture. We think that we have quite a large job that we do for the state of Oregon, and we don't have a huge staff, but we have enough to get the job done along with a couple of the packages that we have presented today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. Are there questions? Hello. I have a couple. I'm looking at the very last tab, going through the budget support, detail revenue and expenditures. And I don't know if you're going to be able to answer much, but I'm on page 4 of 11, and I'm looking at total payroll expenses, and in since the 01-03 actuals to the governor's recommended budget, showing a 65% increase, and I'm wondering if you can go ahead and respond to that.
Chair Richardson, I'm sorry, I'm on page 4, and you are on line...
Line 1. The other payroll expenses? Are we looking at the same sheet?
Other... other payroll.
I could
turn this over to our management analyst.
Chair Richardson, I will try to start answering this question. Payroll expenses for the 0507 governor's recommended budget include the cost of pension obligation bonds. That were issued as a part, as a result of the PERS reform in 2003. That was in a large part of this increase. Also, the government's recommended budget includes a flexible contribution of about $771 per employee per month. It's a general rate. And also, government's recommended budget includes one-step merit increase for all employees, and that basically returns to the pre-2003 the budget development policy. There were no step increases in 0305.
Okay, would you go up one, two pages to page 2 of 11? Mm-hmm. The last quick bottom of the page, it says temporary appointments, and in the 0305 estimate, we have $40,482, and in the proposed budget, it's $11,640. So I'm wondering, what's changed?
Chair Richardson, we have been working with Ms. Manthe on that because it is not accurately budgeted, and I can't remember what the total adjustment that we have. Fund shift that we've talked about for that particular line item, but I think we've recommended, if possible, shifting some funds out, about $20,000 out, and funding that line item so that it's closer to what we anticipate. It's higher for 0305 because we had two people that. After they returned for a couple of months while we recruited for their position.
Okay. Any further thought?
Mr. Chair, it's not really unusual for an agency's temporary budget to not line up with their actuals. And as Mr. Johnson said, we are working to try to align those to factor out, say, one-time things. Perhaps they have a spike in workload and they relied on temporary employees to get those going. The one shift I thought we had discussed was in all other differentials as opposed to temporaries, but I'll work with the agency to get that more lined up. For example, they might have had some before some vacancy savings, someone's gone, so the savings, the budget was actually up in wages, but they spent it in temporary services. So as we try to factor out all those fluctuations and get the budget trued up for you.
Okay. If you could turn to page 9 of 11. And I'm looking at the PERS costs, and I'm showing that in 2003 the total cost was 39. Am I correct that with the PERS bond contribution and the PERS employee retirement, it's more than doubled since the last biennium? I'm showing 84,560 this time and 39,304 2 years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chair, we're on the wrong...
Okay, page 9 of 11, diversion program.
Oh, diversion program. We were there. In 80...
It's not budget detail.
It's about three different packets within there. You just got to find
one. I'm seeing 39, Chair, and 39,000 and then 61,000.
Yes, but look at the line beneath that, which is also related to PERS. I mean, it's... It may be bond, but if it wasn't bonded, it would have been due. And so, but it's an actual cost. And so, I'm just looking at the two PERS related.
Oh, I see. And you're adding them. I'm sorry, I'm tracking with you now.
And so, I'm looking at roughly, you know, like a 110% increase in one biennium for your cost.
Chair Richardson, I think this is related to what Dr. Fomenko said earlier, in that in 2003-2005. These costs were budgeted in supplies and services and sort of within the state government service charges. And now they have been pulled out of that for the 05-07, she's nodding, so I've got this correct, into personal services accounts.
They're talking about the bonding portion.
Well, both.
Although the bonding didn't come up until after 03. I mean, it would be during 03-05 because we passed it in the 03 session.
And the costs have gone up.
Yeah.
And it's not.
No, it's not. You can't control that, but I'm just pointing out that this is a factor that is huge for you to have to deal with. Even if it's just the PERS line, it's up 64%. If it's just the difference between 39,000 and 61,000, three employees.
But I believe, Chair Richardson, that there would be a somewhat corresponding offset in supplies and services for state government service charges.
Okay, and where's that line then?
So that's not, I don't think that's going to be a good budget. The diversion is not going to.
In 05, it would have been budgeted.
That's.
But then.
It's gone down.
I see. Okay. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Okay, would you please turn to 11 of 11? In the middle of the page, you talk about capital outlay data processing software. And 0103 is $667,000. And then. $699,000 for the last biennium, and this proposed biennium is $936,000. If we charted that by 2015, we're going to be in some serious financial problems, since you guys like charting.
Chair Richardson.
Looking at trends that are going to continue.
If you're looking at line 3400,
yes.
And that's the total for this program.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not on top of this. Okay. All right. Well, would you like to just comment on the trend? We're going up a couple hundred thousand dollars every biennium. And just explain to us.
Chair Richardson, the biggest piece of that is Package 102, which has been and most of that has been withdrawn. So you're looking at a roll up, if you will, that includes Package 102. Pulling that out of this number will get you back to a better trend.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. Other questions, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you explain the reasons and the rationale for withdrawing most of Package 102? Was there...
Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, that is the package that would include confidential mental health services in our diversion program. We had a work group that worked through this for a couple of months, but were unable to come to consensus, and we want to continue that discussion. As I said, I met with the Oregon Psychiatric Association this week. Okay. So once the session's over, we'll resume those talks, and I think we'll have a bill ready for you next session.
Okay. Other questions or comments? All
right.
Okay. Are there any in this room who would like to testify? It's a public meeting. No one signed up. Doesn't look like there is. We appreciate your thoroughness and the responses that you've given us. All of the information has been very thorough, and we appreciate the package that you provided and the good work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you. We are now adjourned.
Thank you.
Tutorial, Mr. Chair?
Yes. I'm scheduled today. Do you remember what...